Hi everyone, it's Paul McVeigh. And if you listened to Leon Lloyd last time on the Psychology of Success, you would have heard a fascinating conversation of what it takes to get to the top of an incredibly challenging and incredibly physical sport in the world of rugby, to be go on and do the kind of things that he did for England and that really, really successful Leicester Tigers team. And there was just so many lessons to be learned from Leon. And with today, our guest is Chris Akabusi. I don't think anyone in the UK or Ireland won't have heard or seen Chris Akabusi over the last 30, 40 years. And I am so looking forward to picking his brains, understanding how he went from having a military background, getting to the pinnacle of elite sport, and then going on having an amazingly successful career in the business world. So let's get into the episode. Hi everyone, and welcome to or welcome back to the Psychology of Success. I'm Paul McVeigh. I'm a Premier League and international footballer. And I must say, when I stopped playing football about 10 or 11 years ago, I worked really hard to get a few extra letters after my name because I went off and studied my master's in psychology because I left school at 16. I thought I'd always like a few extra letters after my name. But today's guest completely puts me to shame. Because not only is he an MBE, he is an OLY, and he's got his MBA. It is, of course, a European champion, a world champion, and a British record holder. It is the irrepressible Chris Akabusi. So, Chris Akabusi, thank you so much for joining me and putting me to shame.
Oh, I don't know about that, Paul. You're looking good, you're sounding good, and you do us good.
Chris, honestly, it is such a pleasure, such an honor to have you here today. And you know me for a little while now, and I've been admiring you for so long, for so far. And I really want to try and understand how you have managed to go on and have such an incredible career over, I think you're into your seventh decade now. That's right. And you can't be in your 60s. Is that true? Just wanted to get that in there early on in the conversation. Yeah. just to try and have something.
It's really funny, Paul, because this morning I've just come back. I did a 5 mile run. I've just done 10 times 50 meter wind up sprints. So yeah, I'm an old codger, but I'm still doing it.
Probably why you've been so successful in your career. But listen, Chris, I'm going to start off the conversation, start off the interview, if that's what you call it, with the same question that I ask everyone. I asked Leon Lloyd it last week, and I'm going to ask every single guest throughout this entire first season of Psychology of Success. What is your definition of success?
Right, okay, so it's really good. I mean, I've learned a lot from you, Paul, for example, just being with you, watching the way that you implement stuff, get done, the way that you like deadlines, the way that you like to be held accountable. And these are things that I've learned from you because these are things that I've probably forgotten over the last sort of 30 years. And so if I was thinking about the definition of success, what I learned from my sporting career, absolute clarity about who you are and what you're about, the ability to be completely dedicated and committed to the cause, to the exclusion of everything else outside of those parameters, and then to be able to be in the moment. Now, I've just given a whole plethora of stuff there, which is not short and definable in a small, neat setting, but it's got to do with the person who's got absolute clarity, totally focused, committed, dedicated to the cause, with the blinkers on, knowing this is it, and staying in that moment.
It's almost as if it's the analogy of in your world and the athletics world, of staying in your lane and just going for the prize, everything that you wanted to achieve. But I suppose just to try and play devil's advocate in this, were there not loads of athletes that you trained with, competed with and against, who were clear about what they wanted, and were really dedicated and still didn't have the career that you had?
Oh, yeah, Paul. Yeah. So there's a whole... the whole series of things that are required to make yourself a world-class athlete. I've met athletes, like you said, committed, dedicated, focused about what they want to deliver, but just didn't have the basic natural talent. I met people who've had natural talent, clear, focused, and dedicated, but just didn't have the ability in the moment, in the here and now, to deliver when it mattered. When it mattered, when it came to getting onto that line and in your lane, looking at seven other people who wanted what you wanted, when the gun went bang, they crumbled. And then you meet a few people. Focus, clarity, committed to the cause, dedicated, in their lane. They've got the natural ability. And when the gun goes bang, they don't step back, they step up. And so you do need to have all of those three things going for you. It's not just about wanting it, desiring it, focus on it. You have good evidence and the ability to step up and not fall down.
Yeah, because that really talks about the whole essence of this program, the series that I want to do. I suppose it's a journey, really, of trying to understand what is the psychology or the psychological makeup of elite people, you know, really successful people in whatever field that happens to be in. But you're starting to touch on the physicality and the technical aspect of being able to do something that very few people can do. But it's interesting you're talking about it's in the moment, because how many athletes, competitors did you train with or train against who were amazing in training and could deliver it in training, but once it came to the big stage, just didn't seem to be able to compete at that level?
Oh, loads of people. No names, no pack drills, military term. But there's loads of people who were absolute phenomenal trainers. Absolutely brilliant trainers. I mean, you know, you'd be still sick in the track and they're still going, they're doing the reps. But it's easy to do it in training. Because if I say it doesn't matter, of course it matters, because they're part and parcel, training is part and parcel of the building blocks to get ready for the games. But there's something about stepping into the arena with 100,000 people focused on your event, seven other people wanting what you want, that can courtesize your ability to let go and let it happen. Some of my best performances, Paul, felt like cheating. It was as if I stepped into an amphitheater, a realm, an otherworldly place where it was no longer just me. This is really difficult to explain, but I became one. I've got a couple of great examples in my mind in the European Championships in 1990, where I was, it's almost an out-of-body experience, and I just blended into the ambience, and it was just like, as if I was observing myself. It was just so easy. It was just cheating. I was just like that. It's just like pouring water out of a jug. It just flowed and across the line, and it was easy.
And that was when you broke the British record as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's when I broke the British record for the first time in 1990. Yeah.
But that's not easy. Like a British record, you know, winning a gold medal in the European Championship, that's not easy. How can you say it's easy, and how can you say it's like cheating?
Well, so there were times when I ran harder and was half a second worse. because I was doing it. The physicality, my muscles, you know, I was doing it. But it was as if, okay, this is going to sound a little bit woo-woo, but it's as if I'd got into a vibration and energy system where it was easy, where I it wasn't just about me. I had flowed into the geist, the spirit of the games. I cannot explain it, but I'd got into some sort of frequency, some sort of area where I was in tune and I was in flow with the moment. That's the analogy. It's like water pouring out of a glass. It was just like everything came together and I was so in tune that it just happened.
Okay, Chris. So let me try and unpack that, because you're talking about coming almost in a flow state. And of course, academics have studied this for years now about how, whether it's an athlete in this flow state, and it's almost this optimal performance state. It could be a musician, you know, given a performance and they just almost become one with the music. It doesn't really matter what it is, but can you describe a little bit more? Because you're saying it's like water being poured, but how can we share this with someone who's never competed in Olympic Games, who's not an athlete? How can you describe that for someone that they will be able to understand, and not only what that feels like, but how you manage to get to that point?
Okay. So I think one of the challenges is this. When we're brought up to try to learn anything, we transport ourselves to the day when we sat in class, there was an expert at the front, he or she lectured to us, we then took it down, wrote it down, regurgitated, and we had to work very, very hard at being precise. I'm talking about the logical side, where 1, 2, 3, 4, you paint by numbers, and that is a way to get stuff done, clearly, and you build slowly but surely. That is definitely a way to get stuff done, and it's an effective way to get stuff done. But then there's another way of learning, which I call monkey see, monkey do, where you just watch. You just watch what happens, and then you imitate. You watch and you imitate. So there's you and me standing in the room, and I throw the ball to you. You catch it. You see what I do, and you throw the ball to me. You don't measure it. You don't think about the angles, 30-degree flight. You don't think about the pace. You don't think about how soft it's going to land. You just do. And I think, in a way, what happens is that you spend your year or 4 years in athletics doing the building blocks, teaching in front of the class, step by step, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you break it down to irreducible parts. And you do your drills, et cetera, et cetera. But then there comes a time when you have to just observe yourself and then just do. And you just, I say you just. Of course, there's a practice element that's come to this, because when we talk about me breaking the British record in, it's 1990, for those who don't know my career, it was 1990 for the first time. Well, I started in 1975. So that's 15 years of step by step, step by step, until I found what you call the flow state or optimal performance state in 1990. So I would not want to say to anybody, oh, yeah, it's really easy, monkey see, monkey do, watch somebody perform, step into their flow and just do. No, you've got to do all the work and the building blocks to get there. But then you observe. So I saw Ed Moses. I saw there was a guy called Hartmut Weber, a German guy, who I observed in the late 70s, early 80s. And he was just so smooth. And so I had a picture. I had a picture in my mind of what it looked. Now, I looked nothing like him. I was an ugly runner. I was a real, and I used to, but I had a picture. And I suspect that I've got into that flow state of that sort of picture, so that I just became it and I just lived it.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Chris, you're saying it takes 15 years to go from starting off in this sport to getting to almost one of the pinnacles of your career. But I suppose just doing it on the track is almost one element of it, because that's the performance side. What were some of the, not sacrifices, because I'm not sure that's necessarily a word I'm happy using. What were some of the things that you needed to push to the side so that you were able to compete in Olympic Games and World Championships on a regular basis?
So if there was a sacrifice, Paul, the sacrifice wasn't mine. The sacrifice was my loved ones. It was my then wife, who I'm still friendly with, my elder children, Ashanti and Shakira, who sacrificed their dad. And, you know, I know that I'm much more involved in the lives of my children today than I was. I'm talking about the minutiae now, the minutiae of my children's lives back in the 80s. So it's the people around you that have to sacrifice, because now this is going to sound awful, but there you go, is the only thing that matters is you. The only thing that matters when you're performing at that level is you. And everything conforms to giving you the optimal environment to be the very best you can possibly be and to deliver in a moment. For me, it's no sacrifice. I'm going to the track. I'm seeing Roger. It's Roger Black, by the way. I'm going to California. I'm going to see Daley Thompson, Edwin Moses, Danny Harris. There's no sacrifice there. I'm out on the track, 10 to 12, barbecue, back on the track, 4 to 6, barbecue, songs on the beach, playing cards. No sacrifice there. This is my life. It's my with world. It's my social environment. It's my buddies. It's my peak performers. You know, I would go from here in November out to California, and I won't come back until April. And, you know, I'm there with world champions. You know, I'm not trying to be the best in the country. I'm monkey see, monkey do. I'm trying to be the best in the world. I'm trying to live up to Daley. I'm trying to live up to Edwin. Now, I don't expect to supersede them, but I want to be with them. I want to be in that company. It's not a sacrifice. It's whatever the opposite to sacrifice, isn't it? It's my pleasure. It's my reckonable service to myself, and I've got to be tested. Not a sacrifice. It's doing everything that I can do so that come the day, the hour, when the authorities say, come all you who think enough to the Olympic arena, I won't leave no stone unturned. I'll be ready to operate, ready to deliver.
See, that is an incredible insight for someone like myself who never really got anywhere near that kind of world-class athletic level. You know, being able to play in the Premier League was really exciting. You know, I managed to do it about 20 times, but it was, you know, I was never anywhere near what you're talking about. That's the likes of the Ronaldos and the Messis or the Shearers and the Gerrards, those kind of, you know, world-class performers. And you're saying just being around them, pushing yourself with them every single day is the only way that you can compete. And it sounds like that you had probably a different attitude to putting that kind of, I don't know, energy and dedication into it. But loads of people wouldn't have been able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I said it now, you know, sort of like 30, 35 years later, I realize how self-centered I was, and you know, and to a degree I still am, I guess, but just not in the same way. But then it just seemed what everyone was doing. When I say everyone was doing it, that's what Daley did, that's what Roger did, that's what Edwin did. It's all about us. It's us in the sunshine, you know, in this little bubble. And You know, they talk about echo chambers. This was it wasn't so extreme. It wasn't so unusual. It wasn't so unique, because those that did. That's what we did. That's how we were. And I mean, it was just great. I mean, it was great putting yourself under the pressure. It was great being in that environment. And it was great coming back to the UK, jump on a plane, go to a race, and see all those guys who were doing it performing, delivering. Because it was then, it was like the feedback in the echo chamber going, yeah, well done, son. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, keep on going. Do you know what I'm saying? So, yeah, you know, I do realise that it may seem quite weird to people listening, but it's just what we did. And it was, you know, I do not know how you operate at that level if you don't do it. I just don't know how you do it because
I think that's the question. That's the question, isn't it, Chris? Really? Because is it possible to even get anywhere close to that unless you have that absolute focus, almost laser-like focus on what you want to do, trying to compete at that level? And I think whenever you're starting to talk about it, it almost starts bringing me into the world of kind of the leaders who were almost leading the sport at the time. So how does it work? Because coming from a team background, you know, our leaders were like our manager or captain or kind of the best performers in the team. How does leadership work when it's just you?
How does leadership work when it's just you? I'm just pausing just to collect. So it isn't just you. And I'm going to make a couple of differentiations. You mentioned Ronaldo and Messi and stuff. I'm clearly not in that league. Daley Thompson, Ed Moses were in that league. I was fortunate to catch like a virus what it took to be in that league. And by osmosis, stickability came down on me. Now, each and every one of us have a small little team around us who are part and parcel of that discourse, that leadership discourse. So, you know, you've got your coach, you've got your trainer, you've got your physio, you've got your weight trainer, you've got your key, like Roger Black was my key performer. You know, Roger and I trained every day together. And then you set up, so like this, it was an informal society. We went to California, where you got all these little planets with their satellites that are flying around, and my satellites being my coach, trainer, et cetera, et cetera, colliding to make this universe where the rules come from. I mean, you've got some of the rules that come from posterity. This is the way that we've always done it. And then you've got some of the rules by someone finds a new way of doing it. And athletics is very, sport is very, someone finds a new way. Everyone does. Oh, we all try that. So all of a sudden we start dieting. I remember, again, 1990, having an awful year where I had to lose weight. I mean, I didn't have anything on me anyway. You know, but everyone was talking about losing weight and being really, really skinny and counting your calories. It was an awful year of counting my calories. And I did that one year, couldn't do that again. But it was a new thing on the block, you know? So these are innovations that people bring in. And the universe, the society in which you are orbiting, you all try out. So I'm still trying to answer the question. It's like there is no one leader. It's ideas that seem to get pulled into the vortex, the gravitational pull of that universe that you all create when your planets and your satellites all come together, all designed to deliver for the Olympics or the World Champions or the Europeans, whatever it is. And Paul, this is all coming out. I've not thought about this. This is all just coming out.
I know. And this is why I'm trying to pick your brains, Chris, because I know there is so much knowledge, so much expertise and experience in there that I'm trying to bring it out in a way so that someone who, I don't know, is going to go and whenever, you know, the world is back going into the office and going into work and doing a 9-to-5, Monday to Friday, and they're going to be listening to this and thinking, how does that work for me? Because I don't have a world-class athlete, you know, either motivating me or training with me every day. I don't have a coach coming along beside me and almost telling me what to do. I really want to try and take the lessons from someone like Leon Lloyd or yourself or anyone else who's been in that world-class arena. How can we translate those and help people who are going in to do the job but want to be able to learn from Chris Akabusi?
So, Paul, here, simple. I'll say simple. Here's a pithy saying. Don't look up to role models. Look into them. So, whatever walk of life you are in, you will have key experts in the field. And they're not a million miles away. They might seem a million miles away. Pick up the blower. That's a telephone. Pick up the telephone. Do emails. Pester power. Get in contact with them. Somehow, hook or by crook. Or if not them first, the person close to them, so that you can get close to them. Ed Moses, so the story with me, Ed Moses, I mean, I was running the 400, wanted to run the 400 meter hurdles. Within 6 months of deciding to want to run the 400 meter hurdles, I was in California training with Ed Moses. Because I wanted it so much. So, Ed Daly invited me to UCI, University of California, Irvine, in 85, 86, yeah. 85, 86, yeah. So the summer of 85 into the winter of 86, January 86. So I went there with Daly. Edwin used to train on the track, but not at the same time as us. In 86, Roger Black and Derek Redmond came on the scene and I realised that I wasn't going to be able to cut it as a fun bit of flat runner. And I had a very tough decision to make. Winter 86. So in the summer 86 into the winter 87. And when I decided to want to do the hurdles, and I put it out there, Daly, who I did know, said, well, you do know that Edwin trains at UC Irvine. No, I didn't know. Great, okay. So now I do know my mission is to meet Edwin Moses in 87. So when in 87, I go to see the head coach at UC Irvine. Nothing to do with me, but I go and see him. When does Edwin come to the track? Edwin comes around here from 4 to 7. So you go and see him 4 to 7. Now, okay, it does seem it's easier for me, but I still have to put myself there. Who's Akabusi? Akabusi was nobody. You know, Akabusi was nobody in the athletic sense. 84, 85, 86. I mean, I got Olympic silver in the relay, but as an individual, no. I didn't make any finals. I made one team in 84 as an individual performer. But I wasn't anybody. You know, in a scheme of things, sorry, you know. So what I'm trying to say is, and I'm gonna, you know, this sounds woo-woo, because I am talking about energy flows. I am talking about the universe is hard to define. You've got to put it out there. You've got to really, really want it so much. And you've got to start talking. You've got to dare to talk about it. Because you know what? A lot of people want to do a lot of things, but they're so scared and they dare say it just in case they can't do it. So they keep it to themselves and they just have a little dream. Well, no. If you just have a little dream, you keep it to yourself, it's never going to happen. You've got to talk about it. You've got to dare to talk about it. Because once you dare to talk about it, you know what you're saying? I'm prepared to be measured by this. Yeah. I'm prepared to be measured by this. Oh, really? That you'll be surprised. You do not know. Here's another one. When you think they're not looking, they're looking. Who? The person that is there for you to introduce you to a person that you need to meet. When you think they're not looking, they're looking. They're looking at how passionate you are, how committed you are, how dedicated you are, how much you really, really want it. Because you know what? I'm not going to introduce you to somebody. If I introduce you to somebody and they go, he's a waster, doesn't want it. So you got to want it. You got to let people really, really know that you want it. Really, really want it. Because then the people who are looking will tell you they are looking and they'll introduce you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. Please do remember that, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. Now, Chris, you're talking about, that's just the power of association. That's just about your network. That's just about wanting it. That's about talking about it. There's so many little things there that are all part of the building blocks. If we go from you performed at the highest level, so it's almost like the performance element needs to come first. That's what takes you to that world-class arena. But as you're talking about being around a Daley Thompson or an Edwin Moses, it's almost having that aspirational leadership to get up to their level. But no one does it by themselves. And so I really feel like that everything I've done or I see and observe people doing, it's either performance, it's leadership, or it's teamwork. And you start talking about the teamwork of, even though you're an individual athlete, then you go into the team element, but it's not just the team you're running with, it's everyone else around you. So what do you think are some of the most important elements when you were competing in that world-class team?
Yeah, you know what? Sorry, Paul, I mean, I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but I tell you what, one of the things that just came to me as you were talking, you know who your greatest teammates are? Your competitors. What? Your competitors!
Really? Why? Why do you say that?
Yes! Well, because so when you are in your track on your Jack Jones with your training buddy, a lot of the images are your competitors. You know that they're out there training, right? You know they're out there getting ready, wanting what you want. And then when you get to the track, I mean, okay, I always perform better at the major championships at the end of the year than at any other time in the season. And I could never have performed at that level if I didn't have world-class competitors. World-class competitors where I had to get out of the hole. Boom! And I couldn't just sort of like relax and sit in my block. Boom! You just got to go. World-class competitors where, okay, you're going down the back straight and you're nice and tall and you're going with your stride. But you see, when you come into that second turn, when your heart is like that, and you know, and because there's another part of the psychology, you know, you get a bit of second wind. We can all go through it, but actually, when you start redlining, everything's telling you stop, slow down. But you've got to go through it, and you get a second wind, right? So when it's like that, and you see your competitors, boom, you go through, and then you get another second wind, and you feel really good, and you've got to hit that turn. Well, you wouldn't be able to do that if you didn't have world-class competitors all hitting the turn. No, you can do county championships where everyone's taking it easy around that turn, ready to save something for the home straight. But it's a world-class competition. So you are co-creators of this environment. That is your team, your peak performance team. Know them, know you. You know, my time is a little bit of detail, but 47.82 seconds is my British record. But it's not my time. It was our time. It was a time required in order to in that case, come third at the Olympic Games. And I was dragged along in the vortex of the new world record holder, Kevin Young, who was 8 meters down the track. No Kevin Young, no me. So actually, your biggest collaborators are your competitors. You need to see what they're doing and then trump it more. And just bring the best out of yourself.
So that makes me think how, as I was kind of coming through the footballing world, it was always to do with who I was competing with and against that almost dictated my performance, because I was never the best player in the team, Chris. I was never the worst. I was always somewhere in the middle. But that kind of average performance always seemed to improve and get better as I went from the under 16 to the under 18 to the men's team to the reserves team to the first team to the Premier League. And it was really just about the people I was playing with. And I think that says a little bit more about my ability to learn fast and from the people around me, as opposed to what I think I should be doing. Was that the same with you?
Yes. I want to say yeah. So for me, it was the people that I was with, you know. So I joined a guy called Todd Bennett's group. So this is another example. You see, from 1979 to, I just stayed in the army. I was just running around in the army, you know. And then in 1982, there's a guy called Todd Bennett, and he's no longer. He won the European Juniors in 1982, and he trained in Southampton. And Mike Smith, his coach, spoke at the Army Championship. After the Army Championships, he spoke, just talked about athletics. Wow, Todd Bennett's coach. Yeah. So I said, I'd like to train with Todd Bennett. He said, oh yeah, really? We train in Southampton. Where? I said, well, if you want to train with Todd Bennett, you go and find it. Well, so this is, guess what I did? I went around training for Southampton looking for Todd Bennett's coach and Todd Bennett. I just drove to Southampton. Oh no, it doesn't, they only train down on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Okay, I'll come down on Thursday. So I stood outside. I saw Todd Bennett. Todd Bennett's coach. What I want to say to you is that I had to make the effort to go from, and then in going to Southampton and meeting Todd Bennett and meeting Todd Bennett's coach, there was a big group and I was down the pecking order. And you know, there was a lot of average athletes and I was down the pecking order. But because I was training them, I'd see Todd and I'd train with a group where you do your repetitions. And then week by week, month by month, I got the pecking order. Until by the end of 82, I was on Todd's jockstrap. 83, I'm in a British team. So I sort of, again, caught it like a virus. Todd went from being, wow, European junior champion in a British team, to being, it's Todd. And I caught it. I just caught it. Okay, so now, you're no longer afraid of being and that year in 83, after being with Todd for 6 months, I became the UK champion. I went from being an Army junior champion, so Army senior champion, and service champion, to being British champion. Now, I was a cart horse, I wasn't the quickest person in the world. But because I got into that group and I came up the pecking order and I saw what they did, I just caught it. And I'm trying to say that's exactly what happened in 86 when I went from Todd's group to Ed Moses and Daley Thompson. I caught it. You just catch it. It's like osmosis. You just feel the vibe. You live and you breathe it, and then you have your being. You become it. And it's away from this left brain logical stuff. It's just all this woo woo business. You climb into it. You just become it. You just wear it. It just becomes who you are.
But it sounds like what you caught was the belief that you were capable of doing it.
Yeah, the belief. Of course, but yes, it is. Yeah, there is the belief. But you still got to do it. I mean, a lot of people believe a lot of different things, but they don't do it. There is a mindset. There is a belief. you it's really interesting. But you have to have the physical tools. But I wasn't the quickest. But see, okay, yes. So here we go, Paul. You do have to identify what your strengths are. So my strengths was a physical animalistic energy and a childlike faith that I could do it. I don't know, you know, I was just childlike. I really believed I could do it. I wasn't a big boast or anything, but I just believed it. I believed it. No, I was, you know, I wasn't the quickest sprinter. I could run 10.5, 10.6. Most guys can run 10.2, 10.3. You know, I wasn't lightning fast, but I just believed it. I could run 21.1. That's not quick. They run 20.5. But I just believed it. And you catch it. And of course, when you're there and you're doing it every day, and my strength is my strength. So when it comes to leading the repetitions, okay, I'll take the last one. I'll take it on. And so you've got to know what your strength is and what part of the workload you're going to carry for the team. And then they do their bit, you do your bit, and you're off on your way.
This is so interesting listening to you, because I feel like we're so similar in so many ways, because everything that you're talking about is, even though you're competing at a really high level, you never thought that you were at the same, whether it's speed, because you're talking about a time's everything for your world. For me, it was just, I never thought that I was ever at the kind of level of some of the players I was playing with, whether it was a Teddy Sheringham or a Dean Ashton or a Craig Bellamy or whoever it was. I just never thought I was there. But for some reason, I always thought, well, if they can do it, then so can I. Maybe they just did it slightly better than me.
Exactly, Paul. No, exactly, Paul. We're on the same wavelength. And, you know, I would say, that, yeah, we're on the same wavelength. And that, I mean, there was lots of people with more talent, basic raw talent than me, that just didn't make it because they didn't really believe it. They didn't really believe it. Or they didn't go out on a limb. You know, they were too scared to put it out there and just go for it. What's the worst thing that can happen? You fall over. Like, that happened to me. That happened to me, Paul. So you know, when I realized I wasn't good enough at the flat, because there was Roger Black and Ted Bennett. Roger Black and Derek Redmond, these young kids who came in the block. I changed from the 400 flat to the 400 hurdles. I was 28 now. So that's old for track and field athletics to make a change. And my very
first
one.
It was about 1987, was it?
It's 1987, yes. Okay. It's 1987, yes. Yes. And my very first race in California, and I've been training with, you know, say with Ed and Daly would put the, because I couldn't do the gaps, the 13 strides. I couldn't do the 13 strides between the hurdles. So the boys cheated and they pulled it in. I didn't have a clue. They pulled it in a little bit for me. And so I'd get over Mike with them. Anyway, my very first race, you sit at Irvine, gun goes bang. I'm out of the hole, round the first turn, into the second straight, bam! I smashed the hurdle, I spawned on the track. and you know what? A lot of people don't get back up. I got back up, dusted myself down, finished the race. Obviously, I carried on training. At the end of the year, well, 3 weeks later, I was a British champion in the hurdles. I won the UK championship in the hurdles, and I went to represent my country, went to the world championship in Italy, and I ran 48.7, and I got into the semi-final. I didn't make the final. I think I might have made the final. I can't remember that. It's a long time ago. But what I'm going to say is, I was the best form of the hurdle in the country, having only fell over 4 months ago. I'm now number one in the country, and I made the final. I did. I made the final of the World Champs in 1987.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Chris Akabusi. It's been so interesting and insightful just listening to that journey as you've coming out of the army, becoming a world-class athlete, wanting to be around world-class people in their field. Who's the best in your area? Can you go and find them? Can you go and be with them? Just learn from them in whatever way you can. But if I can just take the last 50 minutes of this, Chris, and talk about whenever you brought your remarkable sporting career to an end. Briefly touch on the transition, but I'm more interested in all of the stuff you did in the speaking world, in the corporate world, all of the keynotes you've delivered, and really just when you understood that you weren't just a performer on the track.
Yeah, great. So briefly, I became, I got a bronze medal in 91 and became the world, and it basically, no, the 4x4 relay. I anchored the British team. We became world champions in 1991. And I was a Christian at the time, and my pastor said to me, oh, this is the mountaintop experience, and you've got to come down into the valley. Someday you've got to come down. And that's often something, it's sometimes people don't realize when they're right at the pinnacle that, yes, this too shall pass. So I made a decision in 1991 that the next year, 92, was going to be my last year. And so I ran that year, made the Olympics, ran faster again. I broke my British record again in 92, and I made a statement, I'm retiring. And no one could believe it because I just broke the British record. But I, as I said earlier on, I was 8 minutes behind a world record holder. I knew I couldn't do that again. So I think the first thing is, in transition, is making a decision. It's actually speaking, I'm retired. And speaking it so that you can't pull it back. And then when I made that decision to retire, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. All I knew is that athletics was the past. But because I retired at the top, doors were opening up everywhere. Now, okay, I'm lucky, but you were the same. When I say you, anyone listening, you will have a series of interests, networks, qualifications that have got you to where you are today. And if you dare say, I'm stopping, doors will open in your sphere of influence. But you've got to say it. Then walk through and then deliver. I don't know if you want to come in there because then I can tell you what happened next. But that was the first thing was actually saying.
And that's the interesting, because we just touched on this with Leon Lloyd last week, and he's a big proponent of transition and coming away from his sporting career in rugby, having, you know, won 2 European Cups and 6 premiership titles, and his team, really successful team. And probably the biggest definition or distinction that he came up with was that you transition to something, not away from something. So it's transitioning to a new role as a transitioning away from rugby, or in your case, Chris, transitioning away from athletics.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a cookie cutter model. I like what he said, transitioning towards something. I knew that athletics was gone, so I was definitely leaving athletics. But yes, okay. Yeah, let me buy into Leon's model, because for me there was opportunity in TV. You know, athletics was front page, back page, high profile. The TV doors were opening, and I liked the idea. You know, big breakfast, record breakers. These were all opportunities that were happening for me. I had to step in and deliver. So maybe you're right. Thank you very much, Leon. I've transitioned into TV, and I went into the TV career, and I loved it, enjoyed it, especially because they liked my personality, a little bit zany, a little bit off the wall, and they just said, just do your stuff. I love live TV because of that, just because they can't call you back and over-direct you, over-produce you. You've got to go and do it. And then on the back of that, I got the opportunity to do a few sales awards because of the relay. People wanted to know psychology success, hand out awards, and I told the story. And before I know it, people wanted to pay me to step on stage, rough around the edges, just like this, you know, just talking about what I know, but rough around the edges. And so what I then did, what I learned from athletics, who are the best people who are speaking? So I went to America again, something called the National Speakers Association, NSA, or Speakers Association. There's a group in the UK, PSA, Professional Speakers Association. And then I went around and watched people speaking like that. Oh, yeah, like that, like that. And then said, don't look up. Don't look up to people. Look into people. I joined the PSA, joined the network, and began to hone my trade and find my way of speaking. I'm anecdotal. I like to tell stories. I like to have a little bit of humor because I like to get paid. So I like to have a little bit of humor. And I found I just found people began to take me on. And I went, that's from 1996 to this present day.
And that's just simply you telling your story of what it takes to get to the Olympics or to world-class performance level. And just similar to what you've said today, even though you've probably gone into slightly more detail on some subjects and in other areas you probably brushed over a little bit, but really just telling the story, how do you get to that world-class level day in, day out, focusing on the prize, making sure you're dedicated, really, really clear about what you're doing, taking accountability, and then going and do it. That's simply all you're sharing.
Yeah. So not now. So that's how where I started. I developed an acronym. The acronym was FIT. Made sense. Athletics, FIT. Mm-hmm. FIT stood for focus, innovation, teamwork. And so I had three key stories around focus, innovation, teamwork. And then off of those branches, there'll be other stories I could feed in. So there'll be a 20-minute speech or a 40-minute speech. And pretty much for the next 10 years, I made a presentation, focus, innovation, teamwork, work. Now, I don't talk about focus, innovation, teamwork. I now talk about existential reality. I now talk about innovation, creativity. I now talk about all of us know more than any one of us. I'm much more into what it is to be a person. Now, obviously, if I'm in a corporate environment, I am led by the person who's paying the fee. So they'll tell you, Chris, we're launching a product and I want you to talk about this. And so then I'll find a database story and talk about that. But I will always, in the end, take it around to, won't hear very long, what are you about? Because that's my serious message. We ain't here very long. What are you about?
And that probably is something where we have had probably our deepest discussions in the last while, whenever you're talking about us as a person and ultimately what that means. And that's something you've studied so much and read so much about recently, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've just got my MA in existential coaching. And existential coaching is about the art of being. What does it mean to be an entity in this world that we find ourselves in? I use the coaching paradigm. So, because existentialism and philosophy can be quite esoteric and out there. And I wanted to bring it from out there into the real world. So, you know, we have our own inner world. So I see the world from my own perspective in the inner world. And then I have a world surrounded by others, which is called a with world. And then we've got an environmental establishment that we're in. And of course, as we do this interview, we have really felt the impact of the environment, the COVID environment, and the technological answer to that, and the way that we've been all locked in. That impinges on our experience of being in the world. And then, of course, then finally, you've got what's called an uber world, a sense of whether you call it a god or a universe or another. And to different degrees, these will impact on our sense of what it is to be an entity in the world. And so I like to deal with that because ultimately, you could argue that a lot of our actions and reactions are to the ultimate ending of all possibilities, which obviously is death. And we have many deaths, a transition in life. I'm at my athletic career. That was a transition. That was a death of an entity. You know, the athlete, the person I'm speaking to you today is not the athlete of 30 years ago. That guy died. You know, and the guy, the TV personality, he's dead. The professional speaker is dying. We're always dying. And ultimately, we lose the physical capacity to be as well. So I deal with that a lot. And it sounds morbid, but actually it's not, because it inspires you to live life passionately in the moment.
I love that, Chris. I really do. And a big thing that I have is really just, I meet so many people, you know, and talk about the regrets that they have. And generally, it's about the things that they regret that they didn't do in their lives. And because, you know, probably like yourself, I'm very fortunate to meet thousands of people generally every year. And instead of waiting until I'm kind of, you know, 70, 80, 90 and looking back at my life and thinking, oh, I wish I had done this, this or this, you know, I'm really clear and focused when I'm going through my life that I want to make sure that I do end up as the 70, 80 or 90 year old and look back and think, wow, you know, what an amazing life I had, and I'm so privileged and blessed and grateful for it. So I really appreciate where you're coming from there. And I think we have time for one more question, Chris. Now, at the start, I asked you, what is the definition of success? And I think you were maybe talking about more as an athlete and what you would have thought of maybe 30, 40 years ago. What is your definition of success for you today?
Yeah. So, Paul, first of all, before I'm going to answer that, how old are you? How old are you, Paul?
I know some people think I look about 14, but I'm actually 43.
Boy wonder. You're 43. So, and you know when you said about living your life, living it passionately, because when you get to 70, 80, 90, you don't want to look back and think, I wish I'd done something. Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, I want to say to you, see, I'm 62. 70 is around the corner. And I can remember when I was 40, I can remember when I was 30, and it's flown by. So when you, Paul, and when people listening hear, I don't want to get the 70, 80, 90, listen, it's much closer than you think. 70, 80, 90 is much closer than you think. So as I'm in my 70th decade, and when I think about what success is, I define success as the life you lead, the lessons you learn, and the legacy you leave. The life you lead, the lessons you learn, and the legacy you leave. And even in that word legacy, there's a hint to the reality. We're here today and we're gone tomorrow. That's not a bad thing. That time frame continuum gives you a nice, neat package to pack it all in vibrantly with passion. And in that package there, you meet people along the way. Your children, for example. Their friends, for example. And the life you've led and the lessons you've learned, you inculcate in them. And there's this butterfly effect. And you will ripple on into the future as you leave the lessons, the hard-earned lessons, in their lives. And that's what inspires me today.
Chris, I can appreciate that. Is absolutely fantastic. I've just loved picking your brain, loved talking to you. I really do appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being here today. We have actually got a special bonus episode of Psychology of Success Live on this Thursday, where we're going to be speaking to NFL quarterback Jay Fiedler, who played for the Miami Dolphins, and that's at 2 p.m. So if you want to join us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, or YouTube, please do join us again if you can. But Chris Akabusi, just finally, thank you again, my friend. Really, really appreciate everything you've shared with us today. And I hope that everyone has taken so much away from it and as much as I have, because that really was inspirational.
Bless you, Paul. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Well, that was just, felt like I'd just done 10 times round 400 meter track, because listening to Chris Akabusi, he sounded like he was out of breath when he was telling the stories, and I'm definitely left breathless just listening to them. But what an incredible guy. Anyone who gets to the Olympics, world champion, European champion, British record holder, you know, simply phenomenal guy. And just listen to his story of what he thought of performance, about the clarity and focus and dedication he needed. And then just talking about leadership. It's just, he thinks it's just a power association. Just being around Daley Thompson and Edwin Moses, just being around these world-class people was exactly what he needed. Then, of course, he started touching on teamwork, and even in an individual sport, just that world-class performance was driven by his competitors. So, so fascinating. But Chris Akinbusi, what an amazing guy. And I think he summed it up best the entire episode right at the end when he talked about the life you lead, the lessons that are learned, and the legacy that's left. Just loved how he brought the entire 60-minute conversation together with that simple little analogy. Hopefully you've enjoyed that. Hopefully you've loved listening to The Psychology of Success. My name's Paul McVeigh, and please join us again for another episode with The Psychology of Success. And finally, I just want to say a special thanks to Moment Digital for the production on today's live show, which is Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Haley Brasnett as the editor, going up on iTunes and Spotify. Dave Webster as the researcher. And for all our social media marketing, big thanks to Emily Drake for all of the team coming together for another episode of The Psychology of Success.